The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly and I'm Allegra Stratton. This week, David Cameron leaves the country for only a few days, but all hell breaks loose at Milbank Tower, his HQ. Student protesters say this is just the beginning. And after months of trailing, Ian Duncan-Smith gets tough on the unemployed. Could it get just as noisy for the quiet man? Plus, the balloon that didn't fly during the election campaign. We explore the ideas behind the big society with one of its chief philosophers. Joining me in the studio for all of this, I have Guardian columnists Gillian Glover and Polly Toynbee, and the political philosopher and new Tory MP for Hereford, Jessie Norman, whose book we'll discuss later on. But first, tens of thousands of students took to the streets this week in opposition to the government's proposals to allow universities to raise tuition fees. But a fringe group of activists diverted to the Tory party's HQ in Milbank Tower, breaking windows and occupying the building. David Cameron's condemned their action from Seoul, where he's attending the latest G20 summit.
I thought it was extremely serious. I could see a line, a thin blue line, of extremely brave police officers trying to hold back a bunch of people who were intent on violence and destruction. They were very brave, those police officers, but as the police themselves have said, there weren't enough of them, and the police response needs to reflect that. So I'm very glad that the Metropolitan Police Commissioner has said what he said, and I think we need to learn the lessons very rapidly.
Jessie, there's a feeling from some of our reporters who were at yesterday's riot, I suppose we should call it, who say that actually, that in general, this feeling out there has been underestimated by the political class. And yesterday was the first sort of intimation of it.
Well, I don't know if that's true. I was in Parliament at the time, and there certainly were an enormous number of people in Whitehall and then in Parliament Square. There was no feeling of it being disorderly. And actually, I think some of the discussion that we've seen has also pointed to the possibility that, you know, an orderly demonstration was being taken over by a bunch of quite violent thugs. So it's really very early to say whether or not it's an evidence of something much deeper. What's interesting has been the amount of other feedback that's come in saying essentially, look, we're in a crisis, but hadn't you noticed, if you see what I mean, and therefore, I suppose, arguing the other way.
But, I mean, I think it was George Osborne himself who said at the time of the emergency budget, we'll have 6-month honeymoon, and it's almost 6 months to the day. I mean, didn't they expect some of this?
Well, I'm sure that the head of the coalition on both the Liberal Democrat and the Conservative side were expecting, you know, some protest, indeed potentially quite a lot of protest, but, you know, whether it was time for 6 months or
no,
2 years.
Yeah, an alarm went.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, it obviously was time to 6 months the day since the coalition came to being, but I don't think that means that, I think the kind of protest they were thinking was not violent so much as systematic argument and lobbying.
Polly, I think you disagree, don't you? I think you think that this is just the beginning of a realisation of the upset out there.
I think it is. I mean, the psychology, the chemistry of riots and demos that go wild is very peculiar, because it always is the people in the front line, whether it was in Grosvenor Square or whatever, are always a handful of sort of Socialist Workers Party types, anarchists, or just people who like a fight. But it only happens at a time when there is a real, genuine groundswell of popular feeling about something. And it's a peculiar combination, and nobody quite knows. And people who studied the French Revolution, looking at who the mob actually were, they weren't the very poorest. I think that what you're going to get is a concatenation of people of really serious grievances. Thatcher never took benefits out of people's pockets. You know, new claimants may have got less, but they are reaching in, taking sizable sums, often out from the same family, over and over and over again. If you think of the row about the 10p, that took a year between announcing it and it coming in. I think we've got quite a long while yet before this really gets going. This is a little foretaste. I imagine by the middle of next year, when people actually find that money has been taken away that they had, and done unfairly, you know, not all in this together, I think a real sense of outrage will bubble over, whether it bubbles over in Brixton-type riots or in student demos that then get joined by lots of other people, I don't know.
But Julian, so images on the television last night, do they? Some Tory ministers say that actually this is quite helpful for us, or...?
I think it probably is quite helpful, and nobody would dare say that. The sight of Conservative headquarters being smashed up, police under threat, fire extinguishers being hurled down from the top of Millbank Tower make it much harder for people who don't agree with that action, and that is the majority of people on this protest and the majority of people who don't like the government's plans on student fees, to put their case, particularly as they don't have an alternative. So they too are just howling at the government's proposals without really putting forward an alternative. So it's degrees of protest, and it makes it trickier for Labour. But more importantly, I think the government is prepared for demonstrations like this, and having demonstrations, having riots even, isn't a sign of a government that's going to lose. Governments lose when the public turn against policy more widely. You can get hundreds of thousands of people on the street. We had it on Iraq, we had it on the Countryside Alliance on hunting. The hunting people thought they'd win because they had a huge demonstration. In the end, it didn't sway the government because the country didn't really care.
I mean, I think that is right. The key point about this is that students are a very small group of people relative to the whole. This isn't like the poll tax. This isn't like there's a very large number of people potentially directly affected by it. And also, I think the other thing is that by the time we get to the middle of next year, in a way, in response to Polly's point, it will be clear that an enormous number of people have been affected negatively in different ways relative to their expectations by the fiscal consolidation, the cuts, whatever you call them. And so the sense of, as it were, shared pain will be greater, and therefore the sense that one particular group has been victimised will be less.
But I think they'll feel it was done really unfairly. If you'd simply said, well, we're raising everybody's income tax, we're all in this together according to your means, but that's not what's happened. Certain people have been picked off. You know, in February we're going to get announcements of enormous bank bonuses. There is going to be a real sense, you know, just on something like child benefit cuts, where most people think it's reasonable for the middle classes not to be given child benefit, then they're suddenly outraged when they realise it's been done in such a bungled, unfair way.
But we're talking now about a student protest, not about all cuts, not about other people protesting.
And the students are always in the vanguard.
Well, they might be always in the vanguard, but they're also wrong on this. And this, they're protesting against a report that was commissioned by a Labour government, against a report which was then adapted by the government to put a cap on the level of fees, and against fees that almost all of them won't pay themselves. So it isn't acceptable for them to portray themselves, and for you as well, to say that this represents a general disquiet against many people who are going to suffer. I think this is quite selfish of students. There are other people who are going to be hit immediately and personally, and much more than these people.
There
who
were
didn't,
lots of buses.
And didn't go out yesterday and smash
agree,
up Tory offices.
I agree,
offices.
And I don't think it's a very good cause, but there were lots of buses that came down, for instance, from Barnsley Further Education College, from other places, with people who were, you know, the actual students from the poorest families who are going to, you know, 16 to 19s on training courses or doing A-levels, who are going to lose £30 a week, you know, which is a huge wallop to take out of the very poorest families. And a lot of them were there, and a lot of those further education lecturers who knew about this too are there. And the cuts that are happening there are really going to hurt the very poorest. And the students have made common cause with them. You know, Aaron Porter has been very careful to say it's about EMA, it's about FE as well.
Jesse, isn't the weird thing about yesterday was that it wasn't Lib Dem HQ, it was Tory HQ.
Nobody knew where Lib Dem HQ was.
And they were very architecturally savvy students.
The police were standing outside waiting for them to turn up at Lib Dem HQ, but as Julian said, no one knows where it is.
Also, you know, County Street is very small. You've got about 4.5 protestors in
there. It's a much nicer building.
And actually, but they're probably on the same side on the inside as well.
So. But I think some of the things that some of the students were saying on the television, there's this promise that's been broken, this pledge that they signed, the NUS pledge that all the Lib Dems signed. I mean, the truth is, it's not a problem for you, it's a problem for them.
I think it's a problem for the coalition if commitments have been made by senior government members, which they have to row back on. I mean, my own view is that politicians should never sign pledges of any kind, and I have a kind of idiotic view that I never sign pledges, I never sign EDMs, and that's proved to be painful
why,
in the short
though?
Term, but wise in the long term. I'll tell you why, because it kind of promotes a pledgetastic politics. I mean, I'm, as you know, idiotically idealistic about these things, but if you look at James Madison, for example, in the 18th century in America, the conventional wisdom at that time was that you never made promises as part of an election because that amounted to treating the public and was a form of electoral bribery. And so I think what you politicians, broadly speaking, should do is to say, this is my record, these are the things I stand for, it's what I've done, it's what I've said, and these are the kinds of things that I think are important. But they should avoid making specific pledges and promises.
That would spell the end of a manifesto, though, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think so, necessarily. I think you would talk about the kinds of things you'd like to do. It wouldn't boil down to specific promises to do certain things. And I think that's...
Julian's nodding. Polly looks horrified.
Well, I think it's particularly difficult for the Lib Dems, because at the time that they were ostentatiously signing away, the party high command knew it didn't really agree with its own policy. It was trying to defer its policy to get rid of fees, and the hypocrisy was greater.
Yes, I think it's very hard. If you go round and you get every single Lib Dem MP to personally sign a piece of paper pledge, I mean, insane of them to have done it.
A few didn't.
There should have been an edict. Nearly all did. It puts them in a very bad place indeed, because it was plain at the time that student fees were going to have to rise, and under any government would. Whether they'd rise to this astronomical level, I don't know. But plainly, student fees are here to stay.
I mean, I suppose there are two other things to say about that. One is that, you know, within a student fee model, this is quite close to a graduate tax version of it. And the second thing, of course, is that Labour has no position of any intellectual or other integrity on this issue at all. I mean, and I think at some point students will come to realise, and this is one of the reasons why it isn't going to be quite the big deal that perhaps somebody expects, that, you know, no party has, from its perspective, an ideal view, let alone an acceptable view.
Well, Miliband has said he's going for a pure graduate.
But Alan Johnson said he's not. And at the next election, I don't believe Labour's going to put forward a manifesto saying abolish fees if you vote Labour. So when students come to vote in those student constituencies, a new generation, not the people who are protesting now, they aren't going to have an easy option of voting to get rid of fees.
The next election is a long way away, but today, Thursday, Ian Duncan Smith has been laying out his plans for reforming welfare. He wants to get tough on those refused to work. It could see jobless people compelled to do community service or lose benefits altogether for up to 3 years if they persistently refuse job offers. Jesse, the Labour government were trying to do some of this, and I suppose the difference is that at the end of their policy there was always a jobs guarantee, and that's not really true of some of the stuff Ian Duncan Smith's trying to do now. He's pushing, but is there anything for them to go into?
I think there's a different, as it were, perspective on the problem in the current coalition government than there was in the previous one. I think the coalition regards the jobs market, and indeed the economy generally, as a much more potentially dynamic thing than it is at the moment. And I think it has a different view of human beings. It doesn't really regard them just in this kind of economic way. It regards them as more as habitual. And so one of the things that I think IDS is trying to do is to create circumstances within a very difficult rearrangement of the chess pieces on the benefits side towards pushing people towards developing habits that actually serve them not merely to get out of unemployment now, but into much healthier and happier working and personal lives. So I think that's the philosophy behind it. And the question is, are these measures too strong a push in that direction? I don't know about the one announced today, but the one over leaked over the weekend, you know, the idea that young people should be, or people in general on job seeker allowance should be given the opportunity of doing community service and encouraged to do community service, being pushed into it, I think is a very good idea. There are lots and lots of things that can be done, and the idea of getting a work habit back is a vital precursor to getting back into the jobs market. If you talk to employers, what is the thing that they care about when someone drops out of the workforce? The answer is early intervention, get back in quickly while the habit is still with you, and while your colleagues are, as it were, recognise that and see it and want you back.
I mean, I agree with that. I'm not an expert on the welfare system. Polly is. I think what's fascinating about the debate we're having in politics at the moment on welfare is the degree of cross-party consensus as to the destination and serious debate as to the problems about how to get there. And I thought the speech that Douglas Alexander gave last week was a serious and interesting speech, because it went through government plans and didn't disagree with everything and then had some detail. And that's where we should be. And it's important in the next few years, as this policy is put through, that it is adapted and changed. We're not going to get now a perfect solution. I think we haven't even had all the detail from it.
But do you agree with Jesse that it's not necessarily about getting people into work? It's about getting people into shape to get them into work.
Well, it has to be. I mean, the state can't always provide jobs. It has to provide the kind of people who can do jobs and then assume that the jobs will be created if that happens. There is no way the government can just magic up jobs from nowhere. And one of the problems with the last government's approach was, you know, Jay Spinell wrote an article this week basically defending quite a lot of what the government's doing, but saying that it is not making the promise which he was making that you would get a job. And he said, you know, nobody believed that because it was too good to be true. Well, I think it was too good to be true. The state can perhaps create employment schemes, and all governments do that. It can't create real jobs in the way that Labour would
too
like.
Too good to be true? They were doing it,
well,
weren't
I think
they?
I think it's absolutely on the same path that Labour was, and that, you know, hugely overblown promise. You know, Ian Duncan Smith has suddenly had a sort of epiphany, and he's discovered the benefit system, and it's unbelievable.
Well, it's not sudden. He's been doing
glitches.
It for some time.
Well, since he went to Easter House and, you know, suddenly, like, St. Paul.
Well, it's five years.
Yeah. But the point is, it's as if he absolutely talks as if nobody has thought and sweated and worried about these things right from Beveridge and before. How do you create the perfect system that has work incentives and yet doesn't reduce people to penury? And one way or another, there are always sharp corners and difficulties. And how you make the tapers smooth into work. I think that technically, they will have managed to smooth out some of the worst bumps. But this is absolutely what Labour was doing. And the big change was Labour's tax credits, which made an enormous difference to the incentives to work. It really did give large numbers of people incentives to work. I think this will help quite a lot of people who weren't helped by that system also to have incentives to work. But basically, whether it was James Purnell, David Blunkett, John Hutton, they've all been working away at the same thing. The idea that Labour was not interested in working with
James Purnell's key argument was that Labour gave up. He said that this was all happening and then Gordon Brown came along and it all stopped and he was scared. And so James Purnell's critic of Labour is not that they weren't trying in the early years, it was that the last Prime Minister did not try.
Well, Purnell has passionate anti-Brown hatred, but Brown was one of
some justice, I think.
Yes, indeed, but he was one of the architects of the New Deal.
You two called for him to go.
Hang on a minute, of the New Deal. And the New Deal was a terrific success when Labour brought it in. And it was also quite tough. It said you've got to take one of four options. There is no fifth option. You big benefit sanctions if you don't do what you're told. And it worked very well.
But I'm amazed you're as hard at ideas as you are, Polly. I mean, for two reasons. First of all, this is obviously a man who's absolutely devoted himself heart and soul to this issue over the last 5 years and become, I think, a great expert in it and published some very serious reports on it. And I would, if I was you, I would be welcoming a person who'd thought as deeply and as hard about this issue as he has to the debate, even if these conclusions are reached for different reasons. I mean, they obviously are utterly sincere and deeply held. They don't feel to me like the product of some daft ideology or relic from some imagined past. So I don't... I feel rather good about where this is coming from.
Well, I think a lot of your constituents will find that when they've got their council tax benefit cut severely and up to the discretion of the local authority, which particularly Conservative ones, when you see housing benefit cut automatically, regardless of your circumstances, when you've been out of work for a year, and a lot of people having to move as a result of that, families uprooted from their schools, when you see that the one thing that gets single mothers back to work is childcare, and they're cutting the childcare credits, the system is better, and he's done that well. But then he's made these cuts that are going to be hugely damaging to people. And, you know, he can't pretend to be generous when he's doing that at the same time.
No, but he's saying all this, isn't it, Polly? I mean, the Conservatives at the moment, rightly or wrongly, are the party of local government. We've got, I think, most councils. You know, if this were a piece of sectional political activity, they would never be doing things that allowed council benefit or council tax to be cut in the way it is, because that would redound immediately against
this. But it is being cut. That's part of the system.
No, but my point is it's not, as it were, it doesn't have the political overlay that perhaps you're giving to it. I think the situation is that we're in a desperate financial crisis and people are trying to address issues in a way that in some ways, even if, as the IFS said, you know, any cuts, again, in some ways to be regressive, at least there's a degree of fairness about it.
Jesse, your book is partly about, it's called The Big Society and it's very critical about Labour and the sort of crowding in of this big state, I suppose, not to use your sort of to paraphrase some of the stuff you say. Are you really saying that universal credit, sort of, if it was sort of was the first thing, would be the best thing? And that the sort of history of tax credits and some of the stuff Brown did was a sort of bad experiment?
Oh, I don't think. I think many Tories are quite interested in tax credits and in many ways supportive of them and supportive of the ideal behind them. And I mean, I don't know how the universal credit is going to work, so I can't really comment on that. But the idea that the benefit system should be drastically simplified so that, as it were, you don't develop a PhD in understanding how the benefit system works, you develop a PhD in something worthwhile and economically useful in your life, drastically simplified, and that its incentives should be continuously as far as possible towards work, and that people who are trapped in some, as it were, habit of non-work or dependency, depending on how you characterise it, get pushed out. Those seem to me all principles that almost anyone from any political party could sign up to, and so I think those are all rather worthwhile.
But just sort of in terms of what the big society can do for this policy thorny problem of getting people into work, you concede that the state and some of the efforts by Gordon Brown were right.
I certainly think that if you had looked at British public services in 1997, there was a very strong case for more investment in them. And that was absolutely right. I mean, tax credits, as I actually analyse in my book, in some respects were catastrophically badly introduced. And they were introduced because the government had the wrong idea of how economics should be, as it were, expressed in policy. It had a very neoliberal conception of economics. It thought that people were as happy about gain as they were about loss. And so when it bounced people into claims which had to be then reclaimed back by the government, it created a lot of completely unnecessary difficulty and sadness and unhappiness. So I'm making a very wide-ranging case for the value of the idea of the big society, including those kinds of economic criticisms of neoliberalism, but also an argument about the nature of our politics and political philosophy and how that feeds into policy and history. And I don't, again, it's impossible to summarize in one sentence, but it is, I think, a well-grounded and worth investigation.
Well, we're going to come on to that one sentence summary in a second, but Polly, very quickly, on the politics of it, is Douglas Alexander doing what he should be doing in his opposition, which is saying we would have done a lot of this, or do you think he could be going in a different direction?
I think it's tricky because I think, you know, a lot of it is going to be good technical stuff. And so, of course, you should always, if you're a sensible opposition, give credit where it's due. But on the other hand, you know, the size of the cuts, you know, big society, it's going to be big soup kitchen. That's what we're going to see. And there's plenty for Labour to oppose and plenty for it to be, you know, plenty of space for it to be generous for the technical improvements in the delivery.
Okay, well, we'll move on to Jesse's book, which is not called Big Soup Kitchen, it's called Big Society. Tim Loughton, who may or may not be a friend of yours, he's Tory minister, he's children's minister, and this week he told an audience on the record that he found it difficult, the quote-unquote unfortunate ministers found it very difficult trying to explain what Big Society was. So in one sentence, Jesse, what's the Big Society?
I think the Big Society is a political philosophy which thinks that there are unimaginable reserves of social energy lurking beneath society and that government can play an important role in liberating them, helping people to help themselves and developing social capital.
And you chart the history of political philosophy from Hobbes to Oakeshott, but you say that the Big Society is the missing bit of the jigsaw. Are you really saying that it's not an idea, sort of someone like Edmund Burke, it's not an idea that's sort of been around before and Cameron is disinterring it?
I absolutely do think it's been around before. I don't think there's anything new here. It's a question of whether the manifest image of politics that we have now and of these issues reflects that deeper understanding. So what you can contrast essentially two traditions. One is what you would call a kind of game theoretic tradition. It begins with Hobbes, and it basically says there are only two kinds of things in our models, political or economic, and they're the state and the individual. And then you start from a state of nature, and that's how the sovereign power gets created by the social contract. And then you can contrast that with what you would call an Aristotelian Burkean tradition, which says, listen, there is no such thing as the state of nature. That's an academic construct. Man's natural state is to be in society. Man is a social animal. And that's where you get the linkage to habit, for example. And the missing ingredient that you get, if you follow that line of thought through, is, as it were, starts with habits, goes on to practices, and ends up with institutions. And so the criticism is that the state-individual traditional view just misses out this crucial third element of institutions, and those are the things that give people's lives point and purpose and energy and meaning, whether it's your local church, the school you take your kids to, or Manchester United Football Club.
Julian, there was a piece in the FT this week showing that levels of philanthropy were down in the recession. I mean, that's sort of a concrete way of saying that people aren't actually using the economic downturn to embrace the big society, isn't it?
No, I mean, it's also predictable if people have less money. That they probably will give less, at least in the short term. I think this big society idea is very, very strong, identifying problems with what we have now reached. And it poses lots of challenges for the left in thinking about the state, as the left often sees, as the absolute embodiment of society. I think there isn't a conflict between society and the state, but at times people on the left think the state is the only way of guaranteeing an outcome. It's the only way of providing that collective social good that we all want. What's fascinating about the big society argument is it's moved away from the market, and the Conservative Party in the 1980s and its traditional thinking would suggest the market was the solution to all problems, and if the state retreated, the market would provide and people would get richer and things would be happy. The big society is an acceptance that isn't always true, and that is much to be welcomed, but it does not guarantee an outcome. And in a society where we would like to be given a guarantee. We don't really expect the guarantee to be fulfilled. We know that things fail, but we still, in the media terms, in political terms, in social terms, we want to be promised something. You can't promise much with the big society. You can only say it will happen.
Yes, there's a lovely quote in the book from Auden where he talks about people hungering for a sign. And I think that is absolutely right. One of the reasons why this is such a difficult idea to get our heads around is that our academic categories don't really recognise it. So we've got well-developed theories of individual rationality and morality, and we've got well-developed theories of state action and politics. But we don't have any theory of what these institutions are in the middle and how they work. And there's a massive plurality of them, and they all differ from each other in many different ways. So it does direct you to a quite different way of thinking about them, and it may be that over the next 100 years, the academics catch up with this very pluralist view.
Bonnie, you are quoted in the intro as saying it's a big fat lie.
Yes, well, I think it's a big fat lie that Labour wasn't interested. Blair was very interested in communitarian ideas, bowling alone, all of that. Brown was too. He put a huge amount of money into volunteering and into supporting charities and getting charities to cooperate together and to take up government contracts and do a lot of the work. And he recognised all of that. They both did. It's very difficult
to
do. And
the Labour Party came from some of these ideas as well.
Indeed. I think that, you know, any politician with an ounce of brain knows that the amount that society depends on volunteering is colossal. I mean, 90% of our justice system is delivered by volunteer magistrates before you even begin on everything else. And so the Conservatives arrive saying, as if it was a kind of, we arrive in this parched Soviet state where nobody is doing any volunteering. And you think, hang on a minute, wherever you look, there's lots of it, and all governments want to encourage it. And of course they should, in every way they can. But what the voluntary sector is saying now is that a lot of seriously good charities are going to the wall and going to go bust. What's what we're going to see in the next years, and quite big names will go down with a crash.
That's true,
they
isn't it,
Jessie? They depend on government money for a lot of the good that they do.
I don't know what the facts are about the big charities, and I'd be interested to see them. Of course, it isn't about volunteering and philanthropy. It's about a transformation across all sectors of the economy and the polity. And so it's as much about government policy and you know, how we think about that as it is about the third sector. And it's also about the private sector. I mean, if you think institutions are important, then you've got to ask yourself why the banks have failed so colossally, not just in economic terms, but in, as it were, social and political terms. And you've got to ask yourself why, as Polly's pointed out very brilliantly, executive compensation at the top of companies has escalated out of control so much. And of course, there are economic reasons for that, but there are also reasons that just come from very bad policy and bad thinking.
I mean, we're sitting in a model, perhaps, of the big society now. The Guardian is not a state organisation, and yet it has a social aim and a collective endeavour. It isn't purely a kind of desiccated market thing. I think what's interesting about what Polly's saying, and she's right, the government changes are going to threaten a lot of the infrastructure which the big society might depend on, but it's the assumption that there will be a connection between the government and these institutions. So Gordon Brown, yes, he wanted volunteering, but his reaction was to give money. The state would tax people and then encourage volunteering. It still saw a central state action.
My favourite is taxpayer-funded community organising.
Yes, precisely. Now, I'm not. I know it's easy to be sort of cynical about that. Sometimes the state does have to do things. You know, the first thing Michael Gove did was start pushing money towards the new schools network. So government does occasionally feel it needs to do it.
Cameron's done that. Cameron's employing 2,500 state-trained community organisers.
One of these
spend their whole time attacking him for the cuts.
Yes, indeed. This does happen. But nonetheless, this idea that the sort of central taxation has to take place in order to allow community action. Maybe that's not going to be the case.
I'm guilty. Jesse go until we pick him up on something he just said.
You can pick me up on anything you like in a second, but let me just follow up
really
to that for a second.
You said about the people being overpaid at the top, that is a major malfunction. What should your government do about it?
Oh, I think they should be insisting on proper corporate governance. I think our corporate governance is a ridiculous spaghetti of overlapping codes which are poorly enforced. You know, I would be looking to introduce some much tougher rules to make shareholders vote properly in shares that they can't get out of, to improve cumulative voting, to remove directors, to break up this kind of mini cartels that exist. I mean, I would be very tough on all those things. And I'm absolutely not. I absolutely recognise Julian's point about the importance of state action to promote things. I mean, a classic example would be, I say in the book, that, you know, we could completely revitalise the teaching and the provision of music throughout the country for half one day's interest on the current deficit. So I think that's exactly, and the reason you do music is because it's a marvelous habit, it's incredibly good for people, it's fantastic discipline and the enormous joy that it creates. So that's the cheapest 60 million quid you'll ever find.
So we learned from Venezuela on that.
Well, I absolutely, and of course the beautiful thing is we
but
have...
our music that's, schools our programme music, has just been cut.
Our music services were each of them a little mini Sistema in the old days. I mean, it's incredible that we haven't...
Polly's right though, isn't she? The money has been cut.
Labour brought one in. It was David Miliband's great thing about music in schools because his wife's a musician, and it's just been cut.
I think Michael Gove has also talked about creating new forms of funding as well, so I don't know what the position is on that. I certainly think that that's something that the government should be investing in a very kind of big society way. Just to go back to the point about voluntarism and voluntary organisations, one of the reasons why the third sector is in difficulty is because for a long time fundraising meant looking for a government pot to bid for. It didn't mean what I would call real fundraising, which is going out and selling an idea to people and getting their support.
But Jesse, that's where the FT piece comes in. Those philanthropy pots are down. So it's not just government pots that are down.
I absolutely acknowledge that. But the question is, can this line of thought change long-range patterns of activity and derive... Because it seems to me, as someone who's raised a lot of money from private sector organisations and indeed helped set up the Roundhouse in London, you know, we did that on the back of an idea. And that was not majority state-funded. I mean, the state came in and was supportive, and it actually provided them. And the energy of that institution comes from the fact that it actually never doffed the cap. It never went Corbyn to any bureaucrat. It raised the money from people to do something that was good, and it did it.
And there are examples of things like, I mean, the hospice movement is an area where the state is not directly funding it, and yet people do.
Yes, it is, almost entirely. It was a wonderful thing. It was a prime example of the best thing that the voluntary sector does. Somebody gets a brilliant idea. It is the beacon of how you should treat people at the end of their lives. But then the state has to come in to make it work everywhere and have lots of hospices. It is majorly funded by the NHS, but it's a wonderful thing. And I think that's the great model, but it does need money from the state.
It needs some money. It doesn't need only money.
Not only, but mostly, most of hospice.
What about lifeboats?
These guys are impossible to shut up. That is it for this week. Thanks to my guests, Polly Toynbee, Julian Clough and Jesse Norman.
They're still arguing.
The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Alex Stratton. Thank you very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook, head to guardian.co.uk/audible.